Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Chadbourne. With me, as always, is Thomas Brooks.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Are you ready?
Oh, I'm so ready.
We are born ready. We are officially going to move away from talking about pseudopsychology and start getting into, like, the real stuff.
Yes.
Pseudopsychology is innocuous, in my opinion. It's pretty tame. And even this is still pretty tame, I guess, compared to some of the other stuff we're going to talk about.
I think today, if it's not on par with learning styles, I still think learning styles are probably the most pernicious thing we've talked about so far.
Yeah, I mean, those do impact kids learning and growing up.
Mm-hmm.
However, there seems to be a lot of growing evidence and consensus that what we're going to talk about today does tie in to kind of increasing the narrative around, like, the modern white supremacist movement.
Huzzah!
And extremism. So,
huzzah!
Yeah, I mean, I guess this doesn't affect as many people as, like, learning styles and all children in the U.S. education system.
Right. I think to just introduce our topic,
yeah,
we're going to be talking about ancient aliens and Atlantis,
yeah,
theories, hypotheses.
Hypotheses.
Or, well, not even hypotheses, really. Like,
it's true, because a hypothesis is an idea you can test.
Structured questions about Atlantis.
Yes. These people are just asking questions. A lot of questions.
I think before we get into it, though, and, like, I'm not going to, like, say that, like, I don't think it's a big deal, but I just want to, like, create some, like, epistemological distance between us and, like, the writers for The Guardian for a moment, who say that this is the most who say that the ancient apocalypse, which concerns the topics of today, is, like, the most dangerous thing, and how could it possibly exist and be allowed to exist, and then just goes on this wonderful journey of bad-mouthing people who like ancient aliens or apocalypse.
Yeah,
mockumentaries, I guess. Like,
the guy who created that is very serious about what he does, Thomas.
He is very serious, but I will say that I watched Ancient Apocalypse, and, like, it was the most, like, enthralling, like, entertainment I've seen. But it is very much couched in ancient aliens editing, if that makes sense. So,
yeah,
like, I'm not about to badmouth people who enjoyed watching that show or, like, follow ancient aliens. Like, it's at the very base level, if you're not into the conspiracy theory, like, it's entertainment, in my opinion.
Yeah. I will say, I have everything that I read for our topic today was written by people in archaeology. So it was people in the know. Things like, why don't archaeologists look at Atlantis?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why are they not looking for it? And much in the same way that you know, an astronomer isn't, or, you know, someone interested in, like, celestial bodies isn't looking into flat Earth.
Questions. Or, like, what happens if you're born under the sun sign of Taurus?
Right. And one of them in particular, and this is Jason Colavito. He's an author on history, science, pop culture. He looks at a bunch of stuff. He writes kind of pop culturally books. But he talks about how, like, the ancient apocalypse isn't, like, the worst example. He actually puts ancient aliens worse than it in terms of just, like, sheer slock and, like, misinformation. And then there's even stuff, like, below that that
right.
gets a little crazier. Like, he uses, it's a lot of the same shows. Things like The Curse of Oak Island, he says, uses the boy's life male bonding veneer to promote Eurocentric historical fantasies ripped from Da Vinci Code. History's rival at the Warner Brothers Discovery Network sent movie star Megan Fox to investigate whether ancestral Native Americans were hybrids of humans and biblical giants. And they paid comedian Rob Riggle to mouth conspiracy theories about aliens in Atlantis. The company, which also owns CNN, has a whole division dedicated solely to paranormal and speculative programming because it's a genre, because it sees the genre as a major moneymaker. Like that's that's why it's promoted. Because it kind of like I guess our maybe we could start with that like little veneer of truth. Like it tickles the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating to think about this and to think about like the what ifs and the what might be's. The problem is that it's all coded in this like, well, all of Western society can build its own stuff, but everyone else, you're not light skinned, then it's aliens or it's mm-hmm. it's Atlanteans or it's you know some other supernatural force that's behind everything. I mean, especially like the whole human hybrid biblical giants were the Native Americans. Like that's offensive. And I'm not, I mean, I would imagine that's offensive.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think they're right. Like if you think about this from like the capitalist, like mode of operation of like, we just need to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, of course this stuff exists. Like it's not there to educate and it's not there to like be true by any means. It's there to tickle the skepticism and the imagination of the viewer in order to make money. And so like I see the little grain of truth here being like, because science is such like a process mm-hmm. and it rarely deals with definitives
mm-hmm.
that there's a lot of open questions that are constantly being researched and reevaluated and replicated. And that's not satisfying in the way yes. that like religion is satisfying, where you get answers to everything that you could possibly ask.
It's also really cheap to make.
It's also very cheap to make. So you have a high profit margin. So like,
yes.
I understand the viewership and the attraction to this media. Like I fully enjoy it. Like I don't particularly like Ancient Aliens because it's like it's the same thing over
yeah.
and over and over. Like it's not good television. I thought Ancient Apocalypse was good television, but it is television. And so I think part of the issue here that's like not being discussed goes back to our learning styles discussion, which yeah. is that this stuff can exist innocuously if you also put in money into education. So that way when right. people are watching it, they have the literacy to understand what they're watching.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when we talk about herbal and natural healing methods a little bit later in the series where we swing even further out of our lane.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a, like, if you were medically literate, then
yeah.
you're like, oh, hey, I can improve my diet and this is a great way to supplement or, you know, whatever, or keep my body healthy in order to get the most out of this medication that I take for my condition. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a part of like the whole, but like when it's sold to you by an MLM that this is the solve, like, you know, hey, let's
right.
take this. It's going to solve all your problems.
And,
that's a failure of literacy.
And you say like out of our lane, but we're probably as versed as anyone who's selling this stuff.
Right. Yeah, I know. That's true.
But also like I would agree. And like part of the issue that we have though, is that even if you're educated, so I'm going to use an example from the same article that there's the spinoff show on hunting Hitler. it's Ancient Aliens, but for the History Channel, because
right,
it has to be
yeah.
about Hitler. Like we're fascinated about like one of the biggest monsters in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like we learn that history. We learn World War II. We learn Hitler's self demise. We learn everything, you know, a lot of stuff that leads up to it. But then these shows come along and say, well, actually, Hitler survived. And like somehow Hitler survived. And we're going to prove that he survived. And and then mistakenly show a picture of one of the Three Stooges and say, this is totally Hitler. And people will believe it. And it's not like the knowledge of the events, because like this is on the History Channel. And so it kind of overrides, like it's coming in a package that seems legit. Like this guy who does the Ancient Apocalypse show, like he writes books on this stuff. He is wrapped in a package of like pseudo-intellectualism where he seems to be, I mean, he probably is an expert on what people think Atlantis is. Sure. But he comes across likely as, you know, he's I think I called him before, and he's the Jordan Peterson of archaeology.
Right.
But I don't even know if he has archaeology training. At least I could say Jordan Peterson's a clinical psychologist. He might have swerved really far in where the literature is today, but he's at least got a degree in clinical psychology. But like these programs will then use these platforms because they're cheap and easy, and they just need people cheap to come on and like spout their nonsense because that's what sells. Apparently on this Hunting Hitler show, or one of the Ancient Aliens spinoffs, and it might have been this one, praised Jan van Helsing, the pen name of a German author of books combining Nazi mythology and anti-Semitic conspiracies. They featured Treasure Force Commander Jovan Pulitzer, a big lie supporter who worked with Republicans to invalidate votes in Georgia and Arizona. But he's the guy who goes and hunts down these treasures to like find Hitler. He was hunting the Ark of the Covenant for the History Channel and the Fountain of Youth for the Science Channel. Like, wow. You can't call yourself the Science Channel. And I mean, I guess you can.
I mean, they do.
Because capitalism. Yeah. And then do a whole series on trying to find the Fountain of Youth.
Right. Well, I mean, I absolutely agree. But I think it just is maybe my heuristic when approaching television. Like, I don't believe that the Learning Channel, I'm going to learn anything of value.
If you would have like grown up, like I grew up, I remember watching the History Channel and like Discovery and like the Learning Channel, and they were actually putting out real documentaries with actual historians. And now it's just Ancient Aliens and Pawn Stars.
Right.
Did
you see the new TLC show that came out recently?
No, I don't have cable anymore, so no.
I don't have it, but it came across my feed. It's MILF Manor.
Yeah, I've heard about that one. And I think it came across my feed and Twitter.
The contestants are these like single moms, and they're like 40s and 50s. And the men in the show are those moms' sons.
Oh, no. Oh, no, Thomas.
It's a Freudian nightmare.
We're in the wrong line of business.
We really are. So, like, I don't know. I feel that, and you mentioned that, like, we learn World War II stuff, but, like, in sixth grade, and it's, like, memory, like, rote memorization stuff. Like, aren't taught how to use that information.
Right. We don't have the literacy. We don't have that, that historical literacy, scientific literacy. Yeah.
And so, like, I would be perfectly content to let History Channel not be about history, Science Channel not to be about science, Learning Channel not to be about learning, if they were treated as entertainment commodities only.
Right. But we can't teach literacy, Thomas, because, like, what happens when you criticize, and if we get criticized for this, this is what we're going to be labeled. If you criticize the works on these like this ancient apocalypse, you're woke. And we're woke, Thomas.
I need some rest. I'm tired of being awake.
Yeah, we're part of this like liberal elite. I mean, I guess we are at a university, and they've got us pegged, Thomas.
Yeah, no, we were PMC long before.
But like, it doesn't matter. Like, you could be like trying to teach that literacy, and suddenly, you know, you're the enemy. You're big archaeology.
Oh my God, I cannot wait for us to dive into big archaeology, because that's the funniest shit about this whole thing.
So yeah, but like, but also what this does is it also feeds into other. So, you know, if you don't have that literacy, but like you're a hardcore Christian, you can find programs on these channels to show you how the Bible is literally true and not just a bunch of really good stories that teach allegory and morals and like, or, you know, like to be worried about these secret organizations that are controlling things like the Illuminati and the Knights Templar and the Freemasons. And they really do like feed for some of those people, like that conspiracy theory itch. That, yeah. Or, yeah.
I think we need to talk to, like, maybe we need to reach out to some of our previous guests in conspiracy theories, because I would
Yeah.
love to know the difference between, like, the non-conspiracy theorist who doesn't touch this stuff versus the non-conspiracy theorist who watches this for entertainment, and, like, maybe the person who has the conspiracy itch but doesn't, just wants it scratched but isn't about to commit to these, like, worldviews or ideologies, and then the person who's like obsessed with like ancient apocalypse because like the Atlanteans are all like frozen in time under the ocean waiting to reemerge in the apocalypse.
Yeah, I wonder if it has to do with, because when I see a lot of this stuff, I know a lot of people watch it. A lot of people watch it because they make so much money on it. But not everyone is like a deep state reptilian believer. And what's that difference? And it may be that those people already believe that there's a secret organization that's controlling things. And then you watch a show that talks about like the Knights Templar and the Freemasons and the Da Vinci Code stuff. And you're like, ooh, that's it. Or like that. You're kind of a quasi World War II buff, but I mean, maybe you've been dabbling in a little Holocaust denial, and then you see like Hitler's still alive and the Holocaust didn't happen. You're like, oh, I don't think any of these programs go that far, but the Hitler is alive stuff at least still happens. And that it might be that you're already there, and this just keeps reinforcing and building on that, and maybe we're likely to see more like intense extremism in these ideas. For that person who was like maybe gonna go rant about the Illuminati on Facebook, but at this point is like starts getting deeper and deeper into some of this, and maybe this leads them down a further rabbit hole as opposed to like, yeah, this is kind of wild and interesting.
And
It
that
makes
kind
me
of.
think of need for closure as one of the psych constructs that seems to be associated with a lot of this. Like needing an answer, not wanting the nuance, not wanting the maybes or the like this might, but like needing a solid answer. And a lot of this gives you that, but it gives you a very fantastical version of it.
I want to pick on the getting stuck in the loop, like you were already kind of there and now you're in
Yeah.
it. It's like that's how the internet works
Yeah.
too, right? Like it's just this constant, like the algorithm catches you and then puts you through this affirmation cycle. And it doesn't matter if you're a part of a conspiracy theory or not, like that happens to us with like higher ed professor stuff on the internet too. Like it knows what to give us to reaffirm our identities and make us feel good, or like give us the significant amount of threat to our identities to get defensive about it and continue to click and scroll and watch and share. And so, like, this may be like a part of this like affirmation algorithm loop that exists. And that's why these shows have shifted so much from the 90s, because they're creating that viewership that comes back again and again and again. And there's people who are not in that loop that come across it. So, like, we talked about a wonderful topic on Reddit before we got on that I won't talk about right now. It's not in our algorithm, but we can still go find it and like scroll through it and enjoy it as entertainment, but then like not be affected by it, as opposed to like the people who are in that community are going to be like constantly reaffirmed for being in that community through these digital spaces.
No, I can agree with that. I mean, this is because it makes money. Like, so if a bunch of people pick it up, because it's all engagement. So you're either watching it because like you hate it and like you want to debunk it, or you're watching it because you love it and agree with it, or you're on the fence, and then by watching more and more of it, you start getting kind of, you know, consumed. And it doesn't matter, you're watching it. And because so many people are watching it, they keep making more and weirder stuff and more all kind of on the edge. And then if it's really controversial, like this Netflix show, then you want people to talk negatively about it because it's all engagement.
Right. And no, that made me think of the Guardian article. I'm like, okay, so like you write this article for the Guardian.
Right.
So that's advertisement for the show that you say is dangerous. And you're also bringing in money and views and clicks to the Guardian from the people who watched the show, who liked it or agree with you to comment on it. So like there are no good actors here because they're all feeding each other views, clicks, and all sorts of other fun monetizable things.
Yeah. And I mean, the way to approach it would be like, and I think some of the articles that I read that they're kind of written from that kind of archaeological perspective might be a little closer. Because at least in that case, they're trying to explain the process and what to look out for and the red flags. And like, here's some of the literacy you can get from it. And so they can then, but there's like the person who's like all in, is it going to read this stuff?
No.
But at the very least, like they can get that information out there. But this information, like where I was pulling stuff from, it wasn't The Guardian. Like it wasn't nearly as popular. It's from more niche within those circles.
And I think that's a good place to pick up on our big archaeology claim and why it's so funny.
Yeah.
Because I think part of the itch that's getting scratched with this ancient apocalypse is that we don't, Graham Hancock and others are taking advantage of a disciplinary crisis that's happening right now, I would say. Archaeology is not doing hot as a degree that people are pursuing right now.
Well, I mean,
none of the like
sense.
None of the social sciences are really like getting into it. Like psych's still popular, but like archaeology is not doing hot. And so they're having a bit of like a crisis of meaning and like drawing people to their discipline for one. So like the idea that there's a big archaeology is hilarious for that reason, because they're, you know, in twilight right now. But also it gets at this crisis of the major theories in archaeology and history that have kind of revolutionized the field a little bit and caused the field to like rethink itself. So whether that be Göbekli Tepe, that has changed the time frame that we think people were doing shit on the planet. And so like he's taking advantage of that crisis of narrative from the last century. And he's also taking advantage of the crisis of like low enrollment and low interest in the field.
Right.
And so I think that's,
Go ahead.
So like, of course the archaeologists are hyper defensive because like they have two major issues that they're dealing with right now. That would be like us like throwing out the DSM instead of making DSM-6.
Right. Yeah. And then someone coming along and saying they have their own perspective about mental health and us getting super defensive about it. And every psychologist having to write some multi-page article in defense of their field and against him. And it doesn't, I mean, but at least I guess you could say in our case, like psych is still kind of popular. And so there are people who are still reading and interested. So there are enough people to kind of defend it and to set up like a wall between like the masses and the knowledge, the truth. But in this case, if you're losing that support, the masses outweigh. No one knows what an archaeologist like really does.
Right. And no, because the last time. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say they watch a show like this that looks at like, you know, have we found, you know, like biblical giants in this area? Like, have we found Noah's grave? And a lot of it is biblical. And so it's really like it's really hitting the mark amongst like a very, you know, particular group of Americans. And when you start including other stuff in that, But yeah, like, but they're not getting that literacy in archaeology, and they don't understand that like this is speculative, and this is basically fan fiction on an archaeological level, like fan fiction about reality. And
And
yeah, we end up with this, so.
no, and I think like part of it too is that like I haven't, and probably the populace as well, haven't really thought about an archaeologist until since like Indiana Jones. So
Yeah.
like if that's your like basis for like thinking about archaeology is Indiana Jones,
Oh,
and then
yeah, I didn't think about that.
like 'cause they don't have like, at least for psych, we have the like, even though it's a nightmare, we have pop psych, which sometimes spits out good stuff occasionally. And that's kind of like a mediator between the public and the academic spheres. But there's not really anything like that for archaeology, to my knowledge,
Yeah, and
besides Indiana Jones.
even like weird media portrayals of psychology or psychologists still like tap into the truth. They're not like super fantastical. But like if your schema for archaeologist is Indiana Jones, if your prototype, then it's tied to the Ark of the Covenant and to all of these really fantastical things. And so yeah, it's tied to aliens now.
Yeah,
Great.
it is tied to aliens with the crystal skulls,
Yeah, ancient aliens, because apparently they built the Aztec pyramids or the Mayan pyramids, which cool.
So like I think part of this, like obviously big archaeology is a joke because like the American
Archaeology ain't big.
Archaeological,
Yeah.
yeah, the American Archaeological Society has no sway on anything that happens.
Right.
I'm
They
sorry,
should.
guys.
If they did, we would see better documentaries on Discovery and the Science Channel and the History Channel and Learning Channel. Yeah, we would actually see decent documentaries if big archaeology actually had anything to do with it. But like they're doing their own research. They don't have the time to put into the show like the Ancient Aliens guy who's got like a degree in exercise sports science. And like, I love my colleagues in exercise sports science, but also like,
I wouldn't invite you to talk about archaeology on a TV show.
exactly. Yeah, no. It's wild. And it's in the danger, I guess, comes from that is if you're in it looking for like, let's say Bible literalism, and then you start getting weird discussions and talks about how like the Native Americans were secretly biblical giants, or there was an ancient civilization that kind of ruled over large swaths of the world, and that they were white, and you're also a white rural Christian who's really into these Bible literalism shows, then that starts to make sense too. Of course, that makes sense. Like God's white, Jesus is white.
Santa
Why
Claus
aren't
is
aliens?
white.
Santa Claus is white. Why aren't these the aliens are white too? I mean, I could go on a whole tangent about like the different kinds of aliens and like how like one of the core species are the Nordics. Like, and they're like
Of course.
tall. Well, see, there's the Nordics, there's also the tall whites. But they're like kind of like your little short grays, they're like taller versions. And
Gotcha.
then the Nordics are kind of like humanoid looking. They're kind of like your Aryans, but they're aliens.
Bro,
And that's
Aryan aliens.
well, and that's what you see with some of this Atlantis stuff, that it has been tied to it was used in World War II. They used stories of Atlantis to say this is where the Aryan nation was. This is where our lost civilization was. But yeah, and these things have been around longer. Hancock gets his initial ideas from this like 1800s book. What's it called? But there's this book that was written in like the 1800s. So he wrote in 95 Fingerprints of the Gods, which was kind of looking at a lot of these things. But it comes from Ignatius Donnelly's 1882 classic Atlanteus, the Antediluvian World. And Hancock's Netflix series adapts his book, which someone else published. Like, medieval and ancient writers have been throwing those similar ideas out there. And really, it all comes down to like Plato using the concept of Atlantis as an allegory of a Greek city-state in the Republic, but that's a whole other thing.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it's what I found going down my rabbit hole with this is that we see not only this want to kind of describe this ancient world, and again, Hancock might be doing it completely sincerely, but it's spouting similar rhetoric that's been used to kind of push a white savior race or a white master race. The Nazis used it with the Aryans. They used Atlantis with that. We see a lot of the same stuff being used. I learned in reading some of this stuff that the Nazis made use of lost civilization fantasies to support their hunt for a vanished Aryan homeland. Andrew Jackson even used a lost prehistoric civilization claim to justify the Indian Removal Act, which ended in the Trail of Tears.
Right.
And so it was sort of this idea like, look, yes, we came to America. Yes, we weren't here first, but actually, we were here first. Our great ancestors had like colonized the world, and they were white like we were. It's kind of the underlying veneer of a lot of this stuff. But he also, I mean, but also like this author brings out that Hancock does, you know, he says that's not to say Hancock doesn't have some nasty classist and colonial ideas. Quote, think about it. Could those farmers who archaeologists tell us never built anything bigger than a shack really have achieved all this? He asks at a Maltese temple. Elsewhere, he complains that hunter-gatherers lacked ambition, the takers of the Atlantean world. Like, yeah, I really like this quote, and this ties into like some of the capitalism stuff that we've talked about. Hancock asks us to privilege one millionaire white man's insistence that greatness comes from a single, centralized, proto-Western monoculture over thousands of scholars from hundreds of cultures working to discover the diverse global contributions to the human story. It's no wonder conservatives like him. Because that's who Hancock is. I mean, Hancock is probably a great example of like the old school archaeologist. Like the guy who had, you know, a lot of money in his family was like, I'm going off to Egypt.
Right.
To explore. And he's British too. So it like helps fit that narrative.
Oh, so. It's perfect. Like Uncle Graham brought us back a sarcophagi from Egypt. We're going to showcase it in the lobby.
Right. Look at all this stuff. We found that. We created that. That's why we have it all in the British Museum.
Right.
That's, of course. And like, if you really buy into this Atlantean, like, monoculture theory, and Atlanteans are described as white, then it's perfectly fine for the dominant Western civilizations to hoard all of that stuff. Because it was originally Atlantean anyway, right?
Right, we're just reclaiming it. Damn,
good lord.
No, I think because I think about the Göbekli Tepe, and like I think about his claim that like hunter gatherers couldn't possibly do this, and like there needs to be a better explanation for things like Göbekli Tepe, because that doesn't exist right now. And so like, with this absence of knowledge that does like legitimately exist, because like he is kind of right, like archaeology has treated hunter-gatherers as like, you know, pre-civilized, like possibly not like us, like just roaming around having a good time building stuff with sticks. And so like that like hole in knowledge that he crafts to like fit Atlantis in there, like that hole exists. So like that's kind of like that grain of truth. And then you'd like, well, what could it be? Atlantis.
Yeah, I mean, but it's also kind of upsetting because like there are things that fill that hole. Like we do know that like hunter-gatherer is like stages behind the agrarian and cultural societies that built the pyramids. Like, mm-hmm. we understand this better. And it may have taken us some time, but that isn't something we like figured out 4 years ago, 5 years ago. Like, we've
Right.
known this. We've known pretty well how people may have like built Stonehenge. Like, this isn't an alien thing. Like, it was complex and it took a lot of manpower and a lot of coordination, but they did it, and they weren't hunter-gatherers. They weren't nomadic at that time. Mm-hmm. They may have been, but that also, I think, ties into like where a lot of this early archaeology comes in with a lot of these predominantly Western, very rich British, and American. I don't want to leave some of the Americans out there, but these predominantly Western archaeologists, quote unquote, who would go and kind of, and then have to conceptualize, like, all right, how could this have happened? Because like, we're more advanced and they're not. And so, or if we look at the example of like a hunter-gatherer society that exists today, of course they couldn't do it because they're not sedentary. Like, mm-hmm. you have to have like, but like, they're able to do so much that like, if they would have settled down, if they would have come together, like, and it's used in this really clever way to kind of create these perceptions of these holes, especially amongst non-white cultures and civilizations. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, hunter-gatherers lacked ambition. Well, no,
no.
because at some point we were all hunter-gatherers. And at some point, that, yeah, and so maybe like the hunter-gatherer group that was so divorced from Egyptian society compared to the Egyptians at the time may have seemed that they lacked ambition, but like they lacked ambition to what? Build pyramids? They didn't need to build pyramids. They could survive by hunting and gathering.
Right. No, like your ambition to hunt and gather to survive is a pretty good ambition, in my opinion.
And you have to be in a fairly like lush environment to be able to keep hunting and gathering. It's when all that runs out, or things are scarce, or you're working in like the small floodplain of a desert where you're like, all right, we got to figure things out. We got to work out things like transporting water to different places and working out all these other little things. Like, yes, you know, the Greeks had to do that because they couldn't hunt and gather anymore.
Right.
Or they got to the size when you have enough people that you can't mm-hmm. do that. So you have to start learning other ways to survive, and we evolve into that. But I don't know.
No, it's a hot mess. And it's like, I don't know. I feel like there's two like, possibly like parallel, well, one parallel and one postulation. The parallel would be like psychology's crisis in the 80s when we finally had to deal with psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
Like, this may be archaeology's time to deal with their, like, you know, British Museum heritage. Like, I don't know, but they don't have good PR. So,
no.
Like, Graham Hancock can run wild. So, that's one thing. And then the other thing that makes me think of is, like, you know, the way that academia and research and disciplines have shifted so much that we're kind of, like, in this, I don't know, I think it's, what is it? Scholar Steve Redhead called it theoretical times, where, like, disciplines don't matter as much anymore, but theorists do. And so, like, nobody knows anything about like Lacanian psychoanalysis, but everybody knows who Slavoj Žižek is.
Yeah.
Nobody knows anything about Jungian psychoanalysis, but everybody knows who Jordan Peterson is.
Yeah.
And so like the idea that these figures move forward and create like pseudo disciplines around them, that where the actual like historical disciplines then move into the background and like out of importance. Mm-hmm. I wonder if this is also a part of that, where like there's a space for an archaeological theorist to move forward and claim the ground
yeah.
because no other legitimate archaeologist has done so yet.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely see that in psychology too. Like, a lot of people don't really understand cognitive psychology, but they'll listen to a Steven Pinker TED Talk.
Or a Loftus TED Talk.
And yeah, that, and it's probably because we're a far bigger society than we've ever been, and we're a more global society. And it's difficult to listen to all voices. You can't read realistically, and this is, I think, one of the arguments of why we get to this point is you, the average person, I mean, even the scholarly person cannot read everything, which is why we're specialized. I can't read all of psychology. I don't know all of psychology.
I mean, by the end
And
of this podcast, we might be.
yes, well, but yeah, so I have to read stuff or like condense stuff. And so some big names tend to rise up. And those big names tend to be like the kind of the I mean, I'll go to the social identities, the exemplar of their field. But if there's a hole, or there's not really anyone doing anything with it. So like Jung in modern psychology would be a great example of that. There's not like a real hardcore modern Jungian. And so someone like Jordan Peterson can fill that gap and kind of play into this same realm of like half truths and elaborations, and like even like the Jungians are like, he doesn't really get it.
We
But
need to
he
do a
doesn't, he doesn't.
revisit on Jung because I'm reading one of his books right now, one of his later books, and it reads like a Jordan Peterson text.
So maybe he does get it.
I think he does get it because I read some crazy shit last night.
So, but like that would make sense though. Like the average person obviously doesn't get it, and Yoon comes across like if you can, if you can condense it, because the average person isn't going to read the Yoon book.
Right. They're not going to read like Man and His Symbols or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the average psychologist isn't going to read a Jung book outside of like a
No.
history class. So yeah, that it opens that gap, it creates that gap for someone to walk through and kind of step up in that field, much in the same way that that other psychologists, usually not in their kind of main trained field, have like jumped into some pop psych realms and become that face, or kept that face despite the fact that the field has kind of moved on. Like Loftus would be kind of quasi example of that, where like she's still talking about the field and she's still involved in psychology, but like most of her big research is from like the 70s and 80s. And so, but she's still really big, but she's also like made herself relevant outside of psychology, and because of that is known. So you don't have to know anything about cognitive psych, but you can watch that Loftus TED Talk. And it makes a lot of sense because it's like condensed, it's easy to understand. And much in the same way as this, that you don't have to understand archaeology. The problem being is that when you start to get some of those half-truths, or you start filling in gaps with your own ideas, your own ideologies, as opposed to using the research that exists, we start to see some of Jordan Peterson's stuff come up, some of the biblical realism that gets it delves into a lot of these archaeological shows, or the aliens.
Right, exactly. And so I think, I don't know, I think this problem will get worse. I'm not terribly
Yeah.
convinced that the, how do I say this in a way that doesn't freak people out? Things go to die on the internet. Like
Yeah.
complex ideas, the utility of ideas, rhetorics, like just look at like the American progressive movement between 2016 and today. Like, you take some good ideas like Medicare for All, right? You put it on the internet and it dies. It no longer becomes useful except for an identity signifier
Yes.
with no action behind it whatsoever. And so I don't know about the danger aspect to Atlantis anymore. Because things get neutered and die on the internet and become part of like the meme space in a way that like Atlantis stuff in the 1800s or with Nazism was like very real political like belief systems that spurred action. I don't see a lot of stuff from the internet spurring a lot of action on the large scale. So like, I think the problem will get worse in that, like, we're going to be like inundated with a bunch of people who don't know what we're talking about. But I don't know if like our Guardian writer here is like, this is dangerous. I'm like, I don't know if it's dangerous. Like, if it's only getting circulated and reinforced within a small group of people in an algorithm who aren't going to get off their ass and do anything about it because they're overworked, underpaid, and like depressed. Like,
yeah.
Is that dangerous?
Yeah, I mean, much in the same way that I wouldn't call Jordan Peterson like the most dangerous psychologist.
Right.
Like, because again, a lot of his ideas are being screamed into the ether of Twitter. And yeah, he's irrelevant in the field of psychology.
Mm-hmm.
But he is relevant amongst people who are utilizing him as part of their own identity. And so it's not really his message, but it's the meme of what he is and what he kind of spouts. So he can still say, like, much like Graham Hancock can still say, like, I'm not a conservative, I'm not on the right, but then say, then go on every right wing talk show or web show or whatever. And again, like, spouting into the void. So this stuff becomes part of that kind of narrative or part of that identity, but not like, like, there are other bigger examples and people who I think spurn that action more than like Hancock or Peterson. I think Peterson is a drop in the bucket when it comes to like creating right-wing extremists.
Right. Yeah. No, like, I don't know. I feel like those memes from these two men just go into identity construction into this hyper real internet space. And so like people like our Guardian writers who are also like chronically on the internet and construct their identities with the internet are obviously very threatened and upset about this.
Yes.
Which is like, that's an understandable feeling, but like, I don't know. I've never come across like a real life Atlantean before.
Yes. Yes.
So
yeah. Outside
and
of
I see a lot of humans face to face in my job. And I get to learn all the things that are going on in their noggin through papers.
Yeah.
So, like, even if I got one.
Yeah. I mean, like, Twitter, if Twitter has 20 million Americans using it, and that's a pretty conservative estimate, or pretty liberal estimate in terms of how many people are using it right now, there are 350 million Americans. So, you know, if even if 100 million Americans were on Twitter, that means that two-thirds of Americans aren't.
Right.
And so statistically, what happens on Twitter is not reality. You see some weird stuff in the wild that like where the meme expands a little bit before, like beyond it, but like they're rare. The person on Facebook spouting Atlantean stuff isn't the same person. Though I will say this thing blew up on Netflix. So like a lot more people were exposed, but even then, you're the first person I've talked to who said they've seen it.
Right, exactly. And I'm like,
I didn't watch it because it's not the kind of weird conspiracy theory stuff I'm interested in. It doesn't scratch my interest itch.
It was fun as shit. Like, what can I say? But like, I also wonder, like, maybe this is like a bias on my end. Like, what is it? Yeah. Self-confirmation bias? Or no, it's what's the bias that you believe other people believe the same things you do?
Oh, see, I know it, but I don't know it.
I know it was featured on one of our episodes.
Yeah, we got away from biases. We're talking about Reddit questions now because the internet.
But like, it could be a cognitive bias of mine that like I think that other people who are watching this also don't take it seriously, but are watching it for fun. And so like that could be the case, that I'm just biased in that way, and that there are like a bunch of true believers and I'm surrounded by like Atlantean truthers. But like, I also think that's just as unlikely. So
it's probably somewhere in between, but also like, it's not something like, especially like the real extreme, like white supremacy side of like the Atlanteans were this ancient white race. They were destroyed by a meteor and they're like Atlantean blood still exists in the purest of people.
Right. Like, and that wasn't like featured in the show whatsoever.
Right. And that's the stuff that like, if you believed it, I think you'd have at least unless you're like out there like screaming on the street corner, and then you're a different kind of conspiracy theorist. But if you're like, if you're a person who's like hardcore into like any white supremacy today, unless you're hanging out with the Proud Boys, you're not telling your college professor about that. You're not letting it slip. I will say though that I have had people try to slip in weird stuff in papers. Like they're few and far between. They're very few and far between, but I have had the occasional like, this is getting a little like out there pseudoscience. Like you really need to rein it in. And then the student doesn't really listen to me and pushes a paper about how like great replacement theory is going to happen. Like, yikes.
Well, like most of the stuff I get is like capitalist propaganda where I like you need to rail this in. Like I'll tell you the paper that I heard about recently that's not for me, it's for somebody else. And I couldn't help it. I laughed in class when the student told me about this paper that they were writing because I couldn't do a poker face because it was just so comical to me.
Okay.
But it's like out there, and I'm like, of course, this is a paper that's being written. Like, this is like standard, like, lib attitudes towards shit. Like, I don't know. It was crazy. I'll tell you afterwards, because
Okay.
in case I don't want to identify or make someone feel targeted.
That's for the best. But
Yeah, I'll share it in a year. Stay tuned, y'all.
and like I'm reading this quote from him, and I think it kind of taps into some of the stuff that we're talking about, because I think that there's things that he's saying that resonate with people, just like I think a lot of like the really basic like 12 rules stuff just resonate because they're memes. They're such basic concepts that of course they resonate with people because you're human and every human thinks like this. It says that humans, as he says in the docuseries, have amnesia about our past. Of course we do, because we learned it in like elementary school and high school, and we've forgotten it since then. A quote, advanced society like was extinguished when the climate changed drastically. We should probably be doing more about climate change then, right? But like that makes sense to me, like that amnesia comment. Except he ties it into the Great Flood. He says that this meteor hit. So, you know, again, we're getting back to that kind of, and I think that also like is why like it's not that we're talking about ancient aliens or we're talking about Atlantis, is that how it gets tied into the memes and the media is the religious side. Is that it just becomes one little extra piece of a part of that like religious identity on the internet. And so you're going to be really interested in like, oh, further proof of the Great Flood. It was really misremembered as this meteor crash. That makes sense, right?
Well, and
Sure.
also you can play at the other field too, because they use the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis in Ancient Aliens, not Ancient Aliens, Ancient Apocalypse, which is like, it is a legitimate hypothesis from what I can gather. It's like controversial, and they have not moved it forward at all because people keep finding conflicting evidence on it. But there is published work on it. But they tie that to our now like almost religious concerns about like the world. We're like nearing apocalypse doomsday from climate change in like 2050 or whatever Greta told us. So, like, you like get your like biblical realism itch on one side for one group of people, but then for another group of people, you get your like, this has happened before. And now we're going to cause another one. Like, you know, so like if you're following Greta, you actually might like believe this stuff too. I don't know.
And again, going back to like, I guess I'll try to capstone us with a little bit of that truth. This is a quote from a Carl Fegans, who's an archaeologist, and says that, quote, every single archaeologist I know would be elated to discover any previously unknown civilization of the Ice Age, or any age for that matter. And much like a lot of this, like, we would love it. Like, I would love hardcore proof of aliens. And I am like not, I mean, I'm a believer in a sense of like probability wise, there's probably life out there. Is it coming here and probing people? Probably not.
Probably
Like,
not.
is there some sort of large ape-like creature like prancing around the woods of North America? Probably not. Would I love a Bigfoot to show itself? Absolutely. 100%. I want it. Like, that would be amazing. It would be like the next step of our understanding of the natural world is to be like this big feet, I guess. Are they still Bigfoots?
Sasquatch eye.
Sasquatches.
Sasquatches.
That if like that would expand our understanding of our world. And the same thing of like with aliens, it would expand our understanding of the universe to such a high degree. I want to believe.
And you know what sucks about this truly is that academia is so terrible that if we did discover a legitimate pre-ice age civilization, we would never know.
Yeah.
We would never know.
Or we would argue again about like, or it would all reverse, where all the academics are like, we have all this proof now. Like, and everyone's like, this is just an academic conspiracy. Those aliens don't exist. You don't have a UFO. I'm like, we do. We're flying it right now. Look at us. And they're like, no, this isn't real aliens. This is this. Because it won't be like, again, there'll be a perception of what Atlantis is supposed to be. And if we were to find it, it's not going to fit all the mythology that they've created about it. Just like if we were to find some sort of Sasquatch, it would not fit all of the Monster Hunter mythology that's been created about it.
And academics are terrible about promoting their work, so we would never hear so about much. It. Like, I would learn, if there was a prehistoric, pre-Ice Age civilization, I would find out from a sophomore in a class that I was teaching because they learned it in their intro to archaeology class, and that is the only contact I would have with that information.
And it would be 20 years after we discovered it.
Yep.
Yeah.
So you're not going to get famous by discovering your pre-Ice Age civilization that will die in an Elsevier journal that will get lost at the end of the next end of the world.
That's so upsetting, Thomas. Yes, but you're right.
Know.
Like, you're absolutely right. Like, it would, yeah, it would go to die, and we wouldn't really be able to talk about it, or we would promote it and put it out there, but it would be so twisted by like second, third, fourth, fifth hand reporting, like that it wouldn't matter. Like, even if you had someone who was good at promoting that stuff and put out an amazing press release, it's going to get twisted, and it'd be like the stuff where they're just like, so it turns out eating chocolate can cure cancer. I'm like,
right,
well, that's not what the article said, but also it was an interesting article. Like, but also like, what? Why did you report it that way? I'm going to have to write like the 12 rules for pre-Ice Age society. Really connect with people.
Really though.
Men are from Atlantis.
If it's not in a Barnes and Noble or in the Walmart book aisle, no one's going to know.
Yeah. Our next book needs to be like, men are from Alpha Centauri, women are from Atlantis. And then like, we just kind of like wrap in the psychology of aliens and but all we have to do is just rehash stuff that other people have written.
Yep.
But like put a pseudo-psychological pop psych spin on it and we'd be billionaires.
Yep.
Be willing to go and like talk to Matt Walsh or something. I don't know. I don't know if that's worth the fame.
Honestly, at this point, like, it's late stage capitalism, baby. The world's ending. Like, I don't care who I talk to anymore. Just enjoy fun things until it's over. Because we'll all be farmers eventually.
Yeah, as much as I'd say it, I'd go on Rogan in a heartbeat.
I would go on Rogan in a heartbeat.
Rogan would let us talk about whatever we wanted. Like, that'd be great.
We need to write our Yoon book and then send it to Rogan. And then we go to Austin.
And we go talk to Rogan. And then that'll get us on all the other shows.
Yep.
And then we can, like, by that point, like, maybe Jordan Peterson will go on. They'll need a new psychologist. And what's better than just one psychologist spouting union revisionism? Two.
Amen.
And then we'll completely sell out because we are in the wrong line of work.
I mean, we're joking, but I literally am like, I have a little bit of a rough draft of a paper for Yoon revisionism going right now. So we'll see how that turns out.
And I mean, I joke, but I would also go on Rogan in a heartbeat.
I would go on Rogan in a heartbeat. I think it'd be so much fun.
Yeah.
I think we would have a good time. So let's go back to our purpose and our mission and our sacred duty to inform people about psychology and turn back to Ask Psychology on Reddit. I have our question, and it will be very helpful because we're going to move out of Atlantis completely.
Okay. Change my mindset.
Yes. Refresh. We're being pseudo-helping psychologists.
Engage
now.
My brain waves away from Atlantean thought and into modern time brainwaves.
The present day.
Yes. Present day brainwaves, not pre-ice age brainwaves.
Yes. So our question is, what, oh God. Okay. They need more help, but we can't help them with everything. What are causes for resentment of routine? For some, routine can cause people to feel out of control, even if they elect to abide by a routine themselves and angry. If consistent, healthy routines are psychologically proven to be mentally beneficial. Then what might cause someone to resent routine, and how might they overcome such resentment for / resistance to routine? One correction, psychology hasn't proved anything.
Yeah, I was going to say, what does psychological proof look like?
I would love to know.
I'm sure it has psychological support.
Yes.
We can support that routine. Healthy routines can be beneficial.
Yes. Yep. So how do we help our dear Reddit user in their resentment and resistant to routine and their quest for psychological well-being?
Well, it's like the idea of getting stuck in a rut. Like you're, you know, I guess to use the kind of like the phrasing where you're kind of doing the same thing over and over again. You kind of feel that you've lost that personal freedom. And it'd probably have more to do if we were in a culture that was like promoting a lot of hardcore freedom. So if you were in a culture or in an environment where going along with the group or more kind of collectivist mindset or like where routine is sort of culturally emphasized, it probably won't bother you as much as it would bother us as Americans who are like freedom, individualism. Mm-hmm. And so that constant routine over and over again becomes a drag. It also makes me think of like the idea, and I'm just kind of like, gotta spitball this because like first time I've heard this question. It also makes me think of too, like the idea of if you're constantly doing the same thing over and over and over again, it becomes boring. And so you're actually losing some of that like cognitive stimulus or cognitive stimulation that you would get from novel experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And as fan researchers, we study novel experiences. And that's one of the core motivators of what gets people into hobbies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it would make sense to me that if you were kind of doing the same thing over and over, especially if it wasn't like engaging. I could say as teaching, like there are days where I do feel I'm doing the same thing over and over again, but there are a lot more novel experiences. There are a lot more questions like this that come up in a class where like that can kind of snap me out of that real quick.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I would say for me, it has to do more with the lack of like those novel experiences, the lack of like something interesting. Mm-hmm. Like even in psychology, I taught one semester, I taught three sections of Psych 101. I gave the same lecture three times in like a 24-hour period.
Ugh.
It was a nightmare. Yeah. I hated it because I hated having to just go in and like repeat myself for the third time and like 2-day period, or it was, you know, it was 24 hours but over 2 days, and I was just like, I can't do this anymore. I was like, I never want to do this again. Two sections is fine if they're like split day, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Tuesday, Thursday, but this was two classes one day and then one class another day, and I lost my mind by the end of it. Mm-hmm. I was like, I can't, like, I need at least a student to ask me a novel question, or we need to talk about something different, but I can't just give the same lecture again. Like, I learned it.
Right.
I can now do Psych 101 by heart, but it was not fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved talking about psychology.
Right. No, in that situation, I would have to each section would have to be a different theme.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same research, same learning outcomes, but like one of them is like the general research psych 101, another one's like fan psychology 101, and then the other one's like human sexuality psychology and relationships 101. So like I'm still hitting the same points, but my examples are different.
Yeah, absolutely,
because that would drive me crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, I could easily see how that could be, and I could see how that, like, that's how it was when I worked retail. I knew mm-hmm. what to expect. It was the same thing every day. It was crushing because there wasn't anything new. I go in, I help the same people with the same problems, same people returning with the same problems. There was never anything novel, mm-hmm. novel enough, I guess. Like, I mean, every now and then something would happen. I'd be like, ooh, that's fun. I'll do that. But yeah, having those ways to kind of break up the monotony, played a big role. And I think that's something we all strive for. I mean, we're all looking for novel experiences, whether it be some mm-hmm. television show, some kind of entertainment. I think there are people who are fine doing the same thing over and over again, but also like they're getting that novel experience elsewhere. They right. have to be.
I think there's also like maybe a cognitive dissonance there too, between, because I think our culture has two different like modes. So yeah. Like you're right, like on one hand it like America freedom, but on the other hand there's like this capitalist mode
oh,
of
yeah.
like hyper routine.
Be a good wage earner.
Yeah, be a fact, like you're a part of the factory line mechanics yourself, like you're just a cog in the machine that should be doing the same things over and over again.
Yep.
But then there's also like this high value placed on like spontaneity and novelty too. And so like I think about this question in terms of like relationship advice, which is like on one hand, like expecting spontaneity in your relationship is unfair to your partner.
Mm-hmm.
But also you can like kill your relationship with too much rigid scheduling and like routine.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so definitely. Like there is like this happy medium in between where it's like if you want to have sex with your partner that night, tell them that morning kind of thing. So like there
yeah.
is an expectation that that's something that's going to happen, but there's enough time to plan the day and reorient and like expect that to happen instead of like you look at her across from the kitchen and your eyes meet and then magic happens on the counter, right? Like that's
never
not realistic.
How it happens. Yeah.
Yeah. But also you probably don't want to say, okay, at 5 p.m. on Wednesdays.
Right.
But so like
that's why communication is important. So you can have that spontaneity, but it could be planned.
Yeah. Like structured novelty is ideal. And so I think part of the problem with this post is that, like, I have a feeling that they went too far into the routine after living yeah. a carefree, unstructured life. And so, like, you know, if you've, like, mapped out your day by 15-minute increments, like, of course you're going to be resentful because that's terrible.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah. you can't expect yourself to be, like, a YouTuber who like, here's my day in a week. And like, they show you like same clip over and over again, just different outfits, like posted on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Like that's unrealistic. Right. And if it is realistic for that person, they worked up to that. They didn't like wake up and say, I'm going to hyper regiment every single day and have it stack everything all at once.
And even for them, it's novel. Cause if they're doing like YouTube stuff, like the stuff that they do on YouTube is still different. So they're still mm-hmm. filming different stuff. They have that novelty elsewhere.
Right.
Even if things are rigid. And it probably also comes from a lot of those like grind set people online where you have that sort of like, here's the perfect routine for success. I mean, they don't include that like it also comes with a job given to them by their parents. But you know, I started working at my dad's company. Like, but also like I get up at 5 a.m. every morning, like so on.
And I don't know. I feel like the best way to approach this is if, because routine is good. Like, I'm not gonna bash routine, but start your routine step by step. Like, don't try to do the whole thing at once. Like, just say, I want to have an efficient 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. morning. Let's work on that 2 hour block or whatever.
Yeah, and then keep expanding it a little bit more. And then if it's not working, if you feel that it's becoming stagnant, got to go back and rethink and adjust.
And allow for stuff to happen. Like, give yourself blocks of time for stuff to happen or designate stuff to do in those blocks. So, if you are teaching, having different lectures in your teaching schedule, your regimented schedule that's forced upon you, it's already going to be novel every single time unless you're teaching three intro classes. And so, using that principle, if you're going to work out, don't just listen to your Spotify playlist. Like, put on something that's stimulating, like an audiobook, and change out the audiobook. Find a podcast like Psychosocial Distancing and listen to that. And change that out. So you get new stuff and new novel things that are happening to you in that block that is regimented, but what happens in that block can change.
Absolutely. And
So.
that is why we should have written this as a book first, so that we could get on the self-help circuit.
Really, though, structuring your life around podcasting.
Structured podcasting.
Psycho-structured podcasting. There's another book in the bag.
Yeah. We'll just add it to our list.
Yep.
So no, that's a good question. And I mean I definitely think that there's a couple of ways to tackle it. I think we kind of hit some of the mark there.
A little bit,
So
I think. Hopefully it was helpful. Or, just set up your life where you're constantly responsible to other people for your routine, and then you have no choice. So you don't have to think about
that's
it.
true, right? But
Yeah,
that could that could become overwhelming.
have a kid, get
Well,
some chickens, and set up a job that you have to clock in at. Boom.
yeah.
Regiment.
I don't know. I think I have enjoyed the freedom that comes with being an academic to the point where like I've said that like I might go completely off the wall if I had to go back to retail.
Oh yeah, that would drive me crazy.
Yeah. 'Cause I can't do that. Like I have a routine, but it's a flexible routine. And I like that flexibility in there.
If
So
the routine breaks for some reason, it's not the end of the world.
no, usually it just means I get to sit in my office and do something
Yep.
else. Oh, no one showed up at my office hours. Well, I got other stuff done. Or I didn't get anything done because no one showed up at my office hours. And that's okay too. I got
Yep.
to decompress in my office.
Yep.
So listen to a podcast like Psychosocial Distancing, available on every major platform. Can't really promote ourselves here. We need to like find other places.
I know, we need to do better.
But we're
I'm
academic, so we're
terrible.
terrible at promotion.
Oh, right. Yeah, I know. Like, we could discover the next big thing in psych and nobody'd ever know about it because we're terrible at this.
Yep. And I guess on that note,
Thanks for listening.
we should probably say goodbye.
Sit, talk at y'all later.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.